While originally cast in disparaging judgment, the Brat Pack label has grown over the years to radiate a warm nostalgia for a time of youth recalled through rose-colored lenses. It was a stigma that ultimately transformed into a loving moniker, a term of great and enduring affection, even as a shadow of its early taint lingered. It has become both a thing and its opposite, harsh rebuke and sweet affection coexisting.
That's actor Andrew McCarthy talking about being one of the founding members of the Brat Pack. The label was used in the 1980s to mock a loosely connected group of up-and-coming actors and films aimed at young audiences. It would turn out to be the defining legacy of that era for the actors and their films. McCarthy was the star of 80s romps and rom-coms like Class, St. Elmo's Fire, and Pretty in Pink. He looks back at his own legacy in his new memoir, Brat, an 80s Story. We caught up with Andrew at his home. He now works as a travel writer and a TV director for shows like Orange is the New Black. He spoke frankly about his unlikely rise in Hollywood, his spot on the Mount Rushmore of 80s movies, his troubles with alcohol, and how he found his love for acting.
There was something about doing it that just made me feel like I inhabited myself completely for the first time and made me feel like, oh, this is how I'm supposed to feel. And I knew it. I mean, I just knew this is me. You know, in a way that I just couldn't describe and never have been able to. I've never needed to be able to sort of dissect it. And all I needed to know was that what it felt like and to be able to sort of trace that whenever I remotely come close to that feeling in anything else to go after it. It was just a knowing without even knowing what the knowing was. It just was.
Was there an element of, I would say, like, maybe that you were escaping, you made sense to yourself, but you were escaping your regular self that maybe you weren't comfortable with at that time, and so this was...
No, I think really acting is the opposite of escaping, and I understand why everyone always, most many people think it's sort of an escaping, but it was really coming home to something.
Yeah, that makes total sense, yeah. You studied acting at New York University for a couple of years, and things really clicked for you when you met an acting teacher named Terry Hayden. Can you tell us a bit about Terry and the impact that she had on you?
Yeah, she was an old method school acting teacher from the Actors Studio. And, you know, I was a 17-year-old kid, and I was not a good student in high school, and I was not doing very well at college as I began. And I just didn't seem to understand a work ethic, I suppose, and I didn't grasp sort of what was required in a certain way. And Terry just saw me. She was the first person. Everybody just needs someone to see them. That's what we all want, is someone to hear us and see us. And she did that for me. She goes, I see you, you know. And she was the first teacher that said, you, whereas my other teachers were kind of dismissive of me and kind of said, what are you doing here? Because I was so kind of fearful in a way that I presented as if I just didn't care. And that was my defense. And it wasn't even a conscious thing. It was just the way it was either exhibit abject terror or present with this kind of aloofness that seemed somewhat of a protective shell. And that seemed to be the better choice to make, although it wasn't a conscious one. And Terry kind of saw through all that and said, you know, you stick around. And it was all I needed, was to hear someone say, stick around, you know, the first person to sort of see me. And we would not be having this conversation if I had not met Terry. You know, and I coming from being a non-student, I always want to advocate for a teacher, you know, and say a teacher changed my life. And because you don't know how we don't know how we affect people's lives, and, you know, in that way. And teachers have that ability, you know, to do that. And she did it to mine. And luckily, at the end of her life, I was able to tell her all that.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. Yeah. Your first big role was in the 1983 film Class. You and Rob Lowe co-starred along with Jacqueline Bisset. And you played a naive prep student who unwittingly has an affair with Rob Lowe's character's mother, played by Bisset. What do you remember most about working on your first feature film?
That I had no idea what the hell was going on. I was so out of my depth in a certain way. You know, I remember they would say, okay, go over and hit that mark on the floor. And I was like, I'm sorry, what do you mean? The piece of tape on the floor over there, go stand on it. I'm like, okay. You know, and I just didn't. And that kind of naivete and that kind of deer in the headlights was very effective for the part, because the guy, Jonathan is the character's name, was very like that in many ways.
God, why am I such a turd?
It happened to anyone here.
Vodka tonic, please. Only a dip would fall for something like that.
Well, you might be right.
But I also had a sense of wonder and awe, and I was a very willing pupil, you know. So that's what sort of saw me through. I think, you know, it's well known that school doesn't prepare you for real life, and acting school does not prepare you for making movies. And so it was a steep learning curve, you know. But I enjoyed it. I loved it. I loved it. And Jacqueline Bisset was so kind to me, whereas she might have just been this kind of pro who was like, oh my God, what's this kid I have to drag through this movie? And she was the opposite. She was so gracious and kind to me.
Yeah, you actually lived with her for a while after class wrapped.
Well, I lived at
right?
her house. I think
at her house. Yes. Yes. Okay.
Slightly different.
Yes.
Slightly different.
Important
that would have really been a 19-year-old's dream. But
yes, it would have. Yeah. Art no, imitating life. Life imitating art. Yeah.
Yeah. She was living with Alexander Gudinov, who was this Russian ballet star who had just defected to the States. And she invited me when the filming was done. She said, what are you doing after the film, Andrew? And I said, I have to go to Los Angeles and find an agent. I've never been to Los Angeles, you know. And so she said, oh, well, stay with me. Los Angeles is a big, lonely town. Come stay with me. And I was like, oh, okay. And so I did. And I lived at her house for some time. And she used to drive me to auditions occasionally, which was this mind-blowing thing. I really should have quit show business right then. That was as good as it ever got.
But no, it wasn't really. But yeah, it might have seemed like it. It obviously would have seemed like it at the time because you didn't know what was going to come later. But yeah, that's great that she was so down to earth and friendly. Whereas you mentioned she could have been... had a lot of attitude and everything. Unfortunately, she wasn't that way at all. That's wonderful. 2 years after you made Class, you were cast in Joel Schumacher's movie, St. Elmo's Fire. And you were worried that because you looked so young, nobody would believe you in the role of a college graduate. How did you deal with this anxiety?
Well, that one turned out to be fairly simple in that I mentioned this to a friend of mine, and he just said, well, you actually are the age of a college graduate. So if you had graduated college, you would have been one. And I went, oh, okay. But really, I think that spoke to a larger thing of this sense of manhood where I didn't have this internal sense that I was, you know, a man. And that when it would take me till I think I was in my 30s to kind of acknowledge that I was a man, you know, as opposed to being just a kid or a guy, you know. And it's just an insecurity. I mean, I had so many insecurities in... back then, as opposed to now where I've got it all sorted out. But that just spoke to, that was an obvious one to sort of point to. There were more complex ones, but that one was sort of fairly easily rectified because that was the fact. I was 22.
Love is an illusion created by lawyer types like yourself to perpetuate another illusion called marriage, to create a reality of divorce and the illusionary need for divorce lawyers.
After St. Elmo's Fire was released in 1985, everything was different. How so?
Well, that was the third movie I'd done, and it was the first time that I felt like I was really holding my own and that I could do this. And I felt that during that movie, no one could have done it better than me. And there wasn't any confidence or anything in that. It was just, I believed, okay, I'm the right guy in the right part at the right time for this. And I knew it. And there was something in that knowing that was, and it wasn't, you know, I didn't feel arrogant. And I don't say it with arrogance. It just was, I was ready and it was my moment there.
Mm-hmm. Most definitely. Yeah. You became a charter member of Hollywood's Brat Pack. What is the origin story behind the Brat Pack label?
The origin story. It's become endowed with such meaning that it now is an origin story. I like that. I mean, the name of the book is Brat, for God's sake. So, yeah, that happened because Emilio Estevez, who was an actor in St. Elmo's Fire, there was going to be a small feature about him in New York Magazine. And Emilio invited the writer out to go drinking with him and Judd Nelson and Rob Lowe, which in hindsight proved to be not a very, you know, smart idea. But anyway, they went out to the Hard Rock Cafe one night, the three of them with the writer, and behaved the way young guys who are getting successful in the movies do when they're in bars drinking and there are pretty women around and sort of behaving in the sort of way that the writer turned off to. And instead of being a small little feature about Emilio, it turned into a cover story of New York Magazine, and he disliked these guys, and he called it the Brat Pack. And that's how it started. And the phrase was so good that it was instantly indelible and soon swallowed up anyone who was young and making movies and in those movies with those guys. And so it became, initially it was cast in this pejorative kind of way of judgmental and negative term. And in the media, it maintained that for years, really. And in the movie industry as well, if you were labeled, you know, I hated the term originally because who wants to be called a brat, and B, it boxes you in, it's labeled, and the minute something's labeled, we're done considering it, we just decided we know what it is, and I suddenly felt, I felt sideswiped by it in a way that was like, well, wait, that's you're not seeing me. You're not seeing me. So I felt labeled and dismissed before I was even seen. And that rankled me, you know, and I resisted that for years. What I didn't understand at the time was that the public really never saw it that way. The public always largely saw it as an affectionate term for these young guys who are in the ultimate in club and they wish they could be too. And that I didn't understand or embrace. And had I done that right away, it probably would have saved me no end of grief. But that's turned into a beautiful thing, which I didn't recognize that or realize that or appreciate that for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And that makes sense in the context of what you say, that the Brat Pack label also elevated you even as it weighed you down.
Absolutely. If I had done the same movies and the Brat Pack term had not been invented, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and understandably so. Next up, you auditioned for the role of Blaine McDonough in the John Hughes film Pretty in Pink, and you read a scene with Molly Ringwald. How did that go?
Well, I had just been in St. Elmo's Fire, and so I was given a courtesy audition. They were not interested in auditioning me because John Hughes had written the part for a high school quarterback star, you know, broad-shouldered guy, jock, and I certainly did not fit that bill. But I was given this courtesy audition, like I say, and I went in and Molly was there reading with people, which is unusual. Actors usually aren't there to do auditions, but she was there and I read with her and I read it once and they said, thank you. And as I walked out, I went, the hell with those people. And then Molly apparently turned to John and said, that's the guy. To which John responded, that wimpy guy? And Molly said, yeah, no, he's poetic and sensitive. That's the kind of guy I'd fall for. And John, you know, to his credit, said, okay.
I was with you. I had a great time. If I was in a Turkish prison, I'd have a great time with you.
I don't know. It's just too weird for me, you know? Maybe this shouldn't happen.
What, you and me? Well, you know, maybe it doesn't happen all the time. It doesn't mean it isn't right, right? Doesn't mean you can't try.
That's what John was so good at. John Hughes was so good at was he not only on screen gave young people respect and credit for having valid opinions and deep, true feelings, but in real life, he honored them. And so he gave into Molly's wish, and the rest is history, as they say.
Forget it!
Get in the car.
Leave me alone.
What are you going to do now? Are you going to go back to Rick? Are you going to run and hide? I really want to know what you're going to do now.
Tell you that one. I don't know.
Come with me. Just leave with me. I'll take you back to school. There's no reason for you to stay. Not here, not in L.A. It's over. Let's go.
Do I look like I'm ready for homework?
You went on to appear in Less Than Zero, which was based on Bret Easton Ellis' debut novel of the same name. The book and the film deal with the growing cocaine culture of the time. And it was during the filming that you actually tried acting while on cocaine. How did that go?
How'd that go? Not so well. Yeah. Yeah, there was just one night I had to dive into a swimming pool and it was unheated, so it was very cold anyway, but I had just done a hit of cocaine, and which does nothing but create tension. So I'm not sure what the thinking was, except that it was sort of the 80s and it was there and it was around and, you know, it was part of the zeitgeist of whatever, and it was 2 a.m. and retired, and any excuse you want you can come up with to do. You can justify anything, right? And anyway, I did some cocaine and I dove in the pool, and I remember just my heart, my chest constricted in a way that was like, oh my God. But, you know, all through the 80s, I had a drinking issue. So this was just a small aside to that. I mean, my drinking issue is much larger than any kind of drug habit I did or didn't have. You know, the drinking was a real thing. The drugs were just, if you had it, I did it. But, you know.
Yeah. How were you able to finally get off alcohol?
You know, luckily, I could not pretend that I handled alcohol well. You know, it began to, it took over my life in a very real way. So I couldn't pretend that it was anything other than what it was, which was complete dependence. And so I just sort of asked for help and went and got help and took care of the problem, you know. So it was very much intertwined. I'm always careful to say that I don't feel that my success, because people often say, well, you were successful too young, so you drank. And I was like, no. I drank because I had an affinity for alcohol, and certainly it affected my career adversely, and being in the movies allowed me to drink better vodka, but I drank because I drank, and I was an alcoholic, not because as a reaction to anything else, you know.
Yeah.
I often think that's a
That's how it goes, I guess. Yeah. Why do you think the movies you made during the 1980s, especially, why do those still resonate with people?
It's so interesting. I suppose it's because what we're just talking about, this John Hughes, and using John as an umbrella term, really, those movies honored young people's emotions. And my son is now 19, and he's in love for the first time. And I can assure you that no one has ever been in love before. You know, he's experiencing, and I felt the same way. I mean, you probably did, many of us did. You know, everything that's happening when you're this age is so intense and so complete and so for the first time that it's ever happened. And as adults, we kind of can go, oh, it's just, you just want to go to a dance. You'll get over it, sweetheart. But no, John saw that it was life and death that Molly go to the dance with the right person. And he honored those kind of feelings and treated them with respect. And I think those movies, looking back now, are certainly of their time, and young people could see them as dated, but the emotions are still the same that people are feeling. And so I think, you know, before that there was kind of Porky's, which was, you know, teen sexcapades or Beach Blanket Bingo or whatever. And those movies really honored that youth.
Mm-hmm. And also I think it gets back, also another reason, I guess, that these films still resonate is something you mentioned earlier about when we were talking about the Brat Pack, about people, it gives them a chance to recapture and revisit their youth. So
yeah, absolutely. And it's so, I've always discovered that it really had, when people come up to me about movies, they need to say things to me. It's not that they need to share what it meant to them. And I just have to be open enough to receive it, you know. Mm-hmm.
You made a couple of films with the great French director, Claude Jabral, and he gave you the best advice you've ever received from a director. What advice did he give you?
Oh, Jabral, I love Jabral. He became a real father figure for me when I needed one. You know, we were talking earlier about my dad, and Jabral, I so respected and had so much affection for him, and he welcomed me so completely into his filmmaking world and his family. I did a couple movies with Jabral in the late 80s. And as a career move, it was probably not very good to go off to Paris and start doing French films. But on an emotional level, for me to have that kind of paternal embrace was wonderful, you know. But Chabrol, one day he gave me a suggestion. We were in a locker room scene, and he wanted me to give the other actor a little. He goes, "Give him a little whack with your towel." And I was like, oh, maestro, I don't really want to, no. And he looked at me and he goes, he held up his hands in surrender and goes, "My dear boy, it is your part. I gave it to you. Ruin it if you want." And so I took that advice. And so I have used that to other people when I'm directing other people. I go, "Look, no, when they resist or suggest, I go, "Look, dude, it's your part. Ruin it if you want." And they invariably do what you suggest.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Andrew McCarthy. It was so great to talk to you. And please congratulate your son for me on becoming the first person ever to fall in love.
Thanks,
what an achievement. It'll look great on his resume.
Thank you.
Andrew McCarthy is the author of the memoir, Brat, an 80s Story. He's also an actor, director, and a travel writer. You can find out more about Andrew at wpr.org/beta.
I wanted to have this moment at the end of the book where we're done with the book, but we're not actually done with the book.
Coming up, Zakiya Dalila Harris talks about her propulsive and suspenseful debut novel, The Other Black Girl. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.